Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound, it's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning into our award-winning Public Affairs program for the people, bringing you even more information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. You know, according to Commissioner Marietta Robinson of the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission, during the course of our 57-minute broadcast this morning, two children will be injured by tipping furniture. And about every 2 weeks, unanchored furniture causes the preventable death of a child somewhere in the United States. So we'll clue everybody in on the Commissioner's Anchor It campaign, a critical call to action to ensure parents and caregivers learn about these dangers and how easy it is to take simple, low-cost steps to prevent these tragedies. Then we'll talk about Best Buddies, a nonprofit dedicated to establishing a volunteer movement, creating opportunities for one-to-one friendships, integrated employment, and leadership development for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. And we'll learn from a program participant about how Best Buddies Citizens Program is matching people with intellectual disabilities to one-on-one friendships with individuals in the corporate and civic world. And then we'll wrap discussing the money you give to do good. Individuals and foundations in Connecticut gave $4.66 billion in charitable contributions in 2013, and about a quarter of that went to education programs and schools. So our last program of the year, we'll try to unpack some of the high points of the Connecticut Council for Philanthropy's annual report, Giving in Connecticut, to try and determine how all this giving is making a difference. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this quick message. Did you know that mattresses and box springs can be recycled? Right here in Connecticut, the steel springs can be processed into new steel. The foam and fiber can be shredded and used in carpet padding and home insulation. The wood can be chipped into mulch or burned as biomass fuel. And the cotton's used to make diesel and locomotive oil filters. To find a mattress recycler in your area, visit buybymattress.com. Well, maybe when you think of furniture, the most risk that you think of is maybe banging your shin on an open drawer, or stubbing your toe on the leg of a chair or a table. But we have learned in recent years about the danger of tipping furniture. And as a result, we are going to have a very important conversation with a very special guest. Marietta Robinson's with us. She is the commissioner of the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission. And thank you for being part of the program this morning, Marietta.
Thank you so much, John. I just so appreciate you bringing this to the public's attention.
So as we were kind of chatting for a few minutes before we turned on the microphone, this is a quite a frustrating situation, not only in your attempts to try to create public awareness, but also in your attempts to try to get the industries that are involved to do a little bit better job patrolling their own safety.
That's exactly right. I mean, this is one of those hidden hazards in the home that are just so, the statistics are appalling. We have, you know, a kid in an emergency room every 24 minutes and a person in the emergency room every 15 minutes from a furniture tip over, and a child dies every 2 weeks, and we just haven't been able to move the needle on this. And it's such an easy problem to fix, easy, cheap, but people just don't even know it's a danger. You know, especially kids when they're under three, they're climbers, and they pull out a drawer and they climb on top, and the furniture comes over on them with or without a television, and we just get these catastrophic situations. And every time I review the news clips for the day and see parents just in such grief over this tragedy that they had no idea was lurking in their home. And on the furniture front, furniture manufacturer front, people should just know. I mean, we, I think, in this country sort of assume that there are certain protections that are built in, and we assume that there are certain standards that people have to meet. And people should know that this furniture, and I'm particularly talking about clothing storage units, there's a voluntary standard that has the absolute minimum stability requirements, but there are some very big players out there, and I'm not allowed to tell you the names of them, but some very big manufacturers who have just decided that they're not even going to comply with that minimum stability standard. So if you just pull out a couple drawers on their dressers, they'll tip over. So it's just a real danger that people need to be aware of. And all they need to do is anchor their furniture to the wall, and they'll take care of that problem.
Right. And at this time of the year, especially now with the great weather that we're sort of having, the unseasonable weather that we're having in the Northeast, a lot of people are doing some redecorating. They're still getting new furniture because they don't have to worry about it snowing or sleeting on their deliveries. Since Black Friday and through the holidays here at the end of the year and into tax season, as people start getting refund checks, they're going out and they're buying new furniture, they're buying new televisions too. So there is a little bit of a focus. While it's not the major culprit, there's also an issue with a lot of these large screen and flat screen TVs that people have been or will continue to be getting at a much greater rate over the holiday season, Marietta. And the thing that's kind of mind-boggling is that as we're growing up, we're hearing, make sure you turn off the stove and don't touch the hot stove and put knives out of reach of children, and we put child proofing on electrical sockets and cabinets and everything. But the idea of anchoring furniture just never really seems to kind of break through the noise of a lot of these other really fundamental safety initiatives.
You're exactly right, John. And, you walk into any home with small children and you'll see the kitchen cabinets are child-proofed and there are gates in front of the stairways, but the furniture is almost never anchored to the wall. And let me just say that, and just apropos of what you were just saying, as people buy the new televisions, what typically happens is the flat screens go in the living room and the parents' room, and the old cathode ray tubes, the heavy ones, go in the child's room, and often on top of a piece of furniture. That is just a catastrophe waiting to happen. Mm. So let me just say that what I would encourage your listeners to do is to go to anchorit.gov, which is a website that we've set up. That, first of all, there's a video there that will very quickly make you appreciate what the danger is. But secondly, there are all sorts of suggestions on it for ways in which you can easily and cheaply anchor the furniture to the wall. And the devices are $5 to $15. And there are devices that do not require holes in the walls. And so that's something that they should check out at anchorit.gov. Now, if for some reason you can't anchor your furniture, I don't care if you move the television to the floor or at a minimum put it on a very low piece of furniture, but just be aware of that danger that's just sitting there waiting to cause a catastrophe.
Yeah, I guess if it's in a kid's room, especially if it's one of these big, massive, heavy, old TVs, you put it on a little, 10 or 12-inch kind of coffee table arrangement, because the kids are going to be down at that level looking. It's not like the kids are going to be, like, up on the bed looking down. They're going to be in front of it. So you're actually putting that TV at their eye level anyway. The thing I wanted to reinforce is, and you said it earlier, every 2 weeks a child dies in the United States when a television or a piece of furniture falls on them. And what's frustrating is when you get the big screen TVs and you take them out of the box, they already are built with anchor components. Yes. On them, like handles and hooks and things where you can do the anchoring. So it's much easier today with the new technology to anchor it.
That's exactly right. And I think most people just don't know it's a danger. They'll see that hook, that handle on the television or the furniture, and unless they've been informed about it, they just don't know. So I just so appreciate you having me on your show today, and I'm trying to get out there as much as I can. So if parents can, and grandparents, because please keep in mind, if you have kids for any reason in your house, you have to be aware of this danger. But if you can anchor your furniture, that's what's going to take care of it. But in the meantime, we at the agency are trying to do the best we can to raise the standard with the furniture manufacturers so that the chests of drawers are more stable, and we're also trying to get more of them to comply with the standard that exists.
And lots of tips and great information at anchorit.gov, a website dedicated to this cause, brought to you by the Consumer Product Safety Commission. Commissioner, at this point, are there any other things on the radar this holiday season that your agency is also keying in on? I know we're on the line to talk about AnchorIt, but at the same time, you've captured the audience from Long Island, New York, and all of Connecticut, big pieces of Rhode Island and Massachusetts. So use the platform. What other things are bothering you or keeping you up this holiday season?
Well, certainly one of them, and I just did a blog about this 2 days ago, and I know that the chair did a blog yesterday as well. Two-wheel, they're called various different things, but hoverboards, and I say that with a small H because I'm not going to mention any manufacturers, but these hoverboards that are have two dangers. One is that people are falling off them, and we're having some very, very serious injuries. But they're also, there's something we're investigating, trying to find out exactly what's wrong with them, but we know that it's related to the battery pack. And it seems to happen when the batteries are fully charged, so they're being used or they're plugged in, and they'll burst spontaneously into flames. Mm. And we've had numerous incidents reported to us, and I know it's been true around the world where they're being marketed. Mm. I know it's a hot item this year, but parents should be aware that it is a danger. Do not leave those charging, the unattended, and don't fully charge them and wrap them in tissue paper and put it under your tree. I mean, there are just so many dangers sitting there with that product that we're trying to get to the bottom of exactly what's wrong with it. And it seems to be across because there's a wide range of prices for them.
Yeah.
And even some of the more expensive ones were having this problem, and it also seems to be irrelevant who the manufacturer is or what the model number is.
Yeah.
So with that product, it's just it's something that parents should be very much aware of as they're thinking about their Christmas gifts.
Yeah, this device kind of came out of nowhere in the marketplace. I mean, it's almost like science fiction, really. But this is something we weren't even really hearing about last holiday season. And in line with what you're saying about the danger is for anybody that has visited an airport recently. I mean, I just recently was in airports in several states, and you can't bring these things on an airplane packed or in your own hand. They won't let them on any airplanes for any reason because of the fire danger of the battery. So certainly it's a wise move to extend that safety precaution to anyone in the home who's buying one of these hover devices for a gift this holiday season.
Exactly.
Great.
I appreciate it. And thank goodness the airlines aren't allowing them for those of us who are going to be flying, right?
Excellent. In the last couple of minutes that we have with you, Commissioner, anything else of interest that's coming down the pike for the Consumer Product Safety Commission, turning your attention to any devices or practices in the new year that folks might need to be looking out for?
We have a number of things on the radar screen. We're certainly another one of the hidden dangers in the home that people don't seem to know about are window blind cords that just keep killing kids. People should understand that if you have children in the home, you just should not have cords on your window blinds. It's really essential that you have cordless blinds. It's just so gut-wrenching, heartbreaking at the ways in which kids can find to pry a cord loose enough so that it fits around their necks, and then they hang themselves, and it's just a horrible, horrible thing. So that we're really focused on trying to figure out how we can get cordless blinds into any homes with children, and we're focused. You know, the one thing about my agency is we have 15,000 product lines, so we're looking at everything from the chemicals that are used as flame retardants in our furniture that have been linked to causing cancer to table saws and just across the board. It's this agency is just doing an enormous job with very limited resources, but we'll just keep trying to make the public as safe as we can.
Right. From toys and cribs and power tools to cigarette lighters and household chemicals, the Consumer Product Safety Commission is charged with protecting the public from unreasonable risks of injury or death associated with the use of thousands of these consumer products under the agency's jurisdiction. Our guest today, Consumer Product Safety Commissioner Marietta Robinson, was talking, of course, about the critically important issue of anchoring heavy furniture. Two children die. About every 2 weeks, a child dies when a television or a piece of furniture falls on them. And every 24 minutes, a child in the U.S. is injured from a TV or furniture tip-over incident. The Consumer Product Safety Commission's anchorit.gov is a dedicated website for where you could go to learn about the danger and learn how to mitigate it. And we appreciate all the great work that the commission is doing under the leadership of our guest this morning. Commissioner Robinson, thank you so much for being
on
the program.
Thank you so much, John.
And happy New Year.
Thank you. You too.
Well, we're in studio right now with a couple guys who are my new best buddies, but they are here coincidentally promoting Best Buddies and the Adult Friendship Program. You know, when people with disabilities are unable to attain or maintain a job, it's most often due to an absence of social skills rather than an inability to perform the work. Best Buddies offers participants socialization and leadership opportunities as well as job coaching, providing the necessary tools for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities to become more independent and more included in the community. As a result of the success of the Best Buddies program, which is more skewed toward younger people, this new adult friendship program has come about. And we're pleased to welcome one of the Connecticut directors and program managers for the adult friendship program out of Best Buddies Connecticut. Zach Zaccoli is here with us. And our very special guest in studio with us is a former Best Buddy and now adult friendship program participant, along with a number of colleagues and friends around the world. Brendan Lemieux is here. He's from Madison, and he's going to be talking with us in just a little while. So, Zach, let's first start with the whole point of confusion that I've been hung up on since I learned about this program many, many years ago. Best Buddies is an independent program that may occasionally work in partnership with Special Olympics, but is not a Special Olympics program.
Exactly. Best Buddies was actually started in 1989 by Anthony Kennedy Shriver in Georgetown University. So that was the first chapter. His mother started Special Olympics.
Yeah, I was
going
to say, and perhaps enhancing
exactly.
the crossover confusion.
Exactly. Yeah. His mother, Eunice, started Special Olympics. So we are pretty closely associated. But Best Buddies is its own organization. We have 8 different programs within Best Buddies. Mostly we're known through the school friendships, which are the middle school, high school, and college chapters. Those get the most exposure throughout the organization. We also offer the Citizens Program, which is the program that I am the manager of. And then we have eBuddies, Promoters, which is another form of the school friendship program. And we also offer Jobs and eBuddies and Ambassadors. Excuse me. So there are a lot of different programs available throughout the age ranges of participants in Best Buddies.
And how did you come to be affiliated with Best Buddies?
So I actually went to school at Quinnipiac University. I'm from New Jersey originally, and I got involved volunteering at Best Buddies, and it truly was the best program I had ever been a program. it changed my life, honestly. So I graduated college. I worked at a school for children with cerebral palsy, and this job opened up. I applied, and here I am today.
Excellent. So let's break down the types of introductions that that parents and caregivers of individuals who come to the program may experience. A little bit about the similarities and differences depending on how old you might be when you come into the Best Buddies program.
Sure. So we like to start with the school friendships. To be a part of the school friendships, you have to attend the school. So with the middle school and high school specifically, the individuals with a disability attend the school through the special education program, and they're paired within an individual within the school as well.
So the best buddies are cohorts within the same school organization.
Exactly. For college, it's a little bit different. Colleges, the individuals with a disability are attached to what we call host sites, mm-hmm. and that could be any program that supports residency or just any sort of life skills growth.
Yep.
And we associate them with the individuals at the college who are the students, and then they form one-to-one friendships. That's our whole mission, is we work for social inclusion through one-to-one mutually enriching friendships. So that is the basis of all of the programs. Now,
and so this idea of both inclusion and socialization, with the ultimate goal of both helping folks in their day-to-day lives in their communities, but also to gain productive employment or engagement in those communities.
Yeah.
That's something that's universal all the way back to if you're coming into the program as a middle schooler.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay.
That's another part of our mission is that we look to add leadership development and integrated employment further down the line through our ambassadors, which I'll touch on in a little bit as well. And then that opens up into our jobs program. But what I'm in charge of is the citizens program.
Mm-hmm.
So for individuals 18 and up, it could range from 18 very easily to 70 or 80, however old the participant.
We have folks of that age in Connecticut.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Yeah. So it's open to that. You don't have to have any association with a school or a host site to participate.
Mm-hmm.
So if an individual with a disability is, let's say, living at home, they don't have a job, they don't have any friends, and their parents really don't know where to turn, and this could be of any age, they don't have to have the host site connection to participate in Best Buddies. They would get matched in a one-to-one friendship with an individual within their community. So we base the friendships on age. We like to keep it within a reasonable age because you don't want to hang out with somebody that's too much older than you or too much younger than you. You might not have similar interests.
Mm-hmm.
So we base it on age, gender. So we patch males to males and women to women. And then proximity. We also like to keep it close. The Citizens Program spans the entire state of Connecticut. So we could have two pairs in Torrington or we can have two pairs in Stamford. There's no boundaries to our friendship program,
and you're saying it's both age and geographical proximity.
Yep.
Do you have situations right now where you're facing a number of individuals who want to be in the Citizens Program, but you're lacking people to match them with?
Absolutely, and that's one of the main reasons why I reached out to you guys to try and help get a nice reach of listeners to participate within the program.
Yeah.
Like, for example, I have a couple individuals with disabilities in the New Haven area, but I might not necessarily have appropriate volunteers,
mm-hmm.
being age, gender, and similar interests,
mm-hmm.
to volunteer. And then that's the whole point.
Yeah.
I have that all over.
So this is the first kind of hearing about the Citizens Program, at mm-hmm. least. I've heard of Best Buddies before, but it sounds kind of like a combination of maybe mentoring and more of a peer-to-peer big brother, big sister kind of situation.
Yeah.
But I would imagine when people hear that they want to get paired up with someone with developmental or other disabilities, that they need to have some expertise in a field or experience with individuals like that to be able to do the job right and to make a difference.
Yeah.
Is that something that you find kind of initially keeps people from engaging with the program to support these individuals?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's completely understandable. It could be a little, maybe not necessarily scary, but people would definitely be a bit hesitant to interact with people with disabilities just because they wouldn't really know the appropriate way to act around them. But Best Buddies, we focus solely on friendship. So when joining this program, that's all that we expect of you, and that is all that we require of you. You don't have to have any history of interactions with people with disabilities. You don't have to have any medical history, like
education. Training.
Yeah, exactly.
Like
exactly.
Yeah.
We're open to anybody. We just we we want to get people involved to be a friend. And that's something simple that everybody can do.
Yeah. So looking out across the state as we speak to you right now in mid-December, where do you stand in terms of the ratio between potential individuals with special needs who want to be in the Citizens Program versus the proportion of people who are currently volunteering, which you need to kind of bolster to kind of fill that gap?
So numbers-wise, it's pretty even, the participant ratio with disability and without disability. But logistically, it's a bit of a problem because, as I said, sometimes it doesn't match up to
geographically
or like gender-wise.
Right.
So it can be a bit difficult to find volunteers for buddies, and it is a bit easier to track down individuals with a disability because there are such great organizations that provide support throughout the entire state.
Right.
That have a good,
as well as state and federal,
yeah, of course,
agencies.
Absolutely, yeah.
Good. So that being said, can you tell us, since we're on we're on 8 radio stations covering the entire state of Connecticut, are at least there some geographic regions or even maybe some specific communities or areas of communities where you need either men or women or specific ages?
Yeah.
Tell us where the greatest gaps are that we might be able to help you fill through the listeners on our program.
Sure. So the greatest area right now would be the New Haven area. We do have a number of participants, both men and women, ranging in age from 20 to 50.
Mm-hmm.
I think there might even be one 60-year-old woman in there as well.
Mm-hmm.
So that area is definitely an area of need, and that could span out to Fairfield as well. Like I said, we try and keep everybody within a 20 to 25-minute drive just because we want it to be a true friendship. You wouldn't want to drive like an hour to go see your friend, regardless of the situation.
Right. Waterbury, Meriden, Middletown, Greater Hartford area, you're much closer to the balance.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's great.
But again, we're open to anybody and everybody signing up. Like, this whole program spans the entire state, so we are always looking for individuals across the entire state.
Yeah, and as you already previously said, this is just one of a number of Best Buddies programs.
Absolutely.
That could bear getting assistance.
Yes.
So that being said, we're going to take a quick break and then come back and talk a little bit more about the Citizens Program and a little bit about how an individual has transitioned very successfully from being in the Best Buddies program to the Citizens Program with our special guest, Brendan Lemieux. We're also with Zach Zaccoli. He is the program manager for adult friendship at Best Buddies Connecticut. Stick with us. We'll be back and talk a little bit more about this after the break.
Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guides tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Boquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. The U.S. Small Business Administration has disaster loan outreach centers in the Connecticut area to help survivors affected by Hurricane Sandy apply for low-interest, long-term disaster loans for physical damages and working capital. SBA's customer service representatives are available at these centers to assist businesses, nonprofit organizations, homeowners, and renters in completing their applications. The centers are open until further notice at Fairfield County's Bigelow Center for Senior Activities, formerly the Fairfield Senior Center on Mona Terrace, from 9 to 5 Monday through Friday, as well as those same hours at the New Haven County Parsons Government Center on West River Street in Milford. Applicants, businesses, and individuals can also obtain information and loan applications by calling 800-659-2955 or by going to complete the application at sba.gov/disaster. The filing deadline for applications for physical property damage and economic injury applications is December 1st, 2016. We're back. Thanks for sticking with us. Zach Zaccoli's here. He is program manager for Adult Friendship with Best Buddies Connecticut. And we are also welcoming into the studio a fine young gentleman, musician, and former best buddy who is now involved in the Citizens Program that we have been talking about in the previous segment, Brendan Lemieux from Madison. So we're going to talk to him in just a couple seconds, but not before we get a little bit of a background introduction from Zach. So, Zach, tell me about your first encounter with Brendan and a little bit about the background you know about him.
Well, actually, it's funny. On the car right here, we were talking about the first time that I met Brendan. So I was involved in the Quinnipiac chapter of Best Buddies throughout my college career, and it was probably around my sophomore year, I think. We have an event in the first Wednesday of March called Spread the Word to End the Word, to end the use of the R word. And Brendan had actually been asked to perform and play some music at this event, and he gave a speech. He's one of our trained ambassadors on speech giving. So he delivered this powerful speech, and he played some amazing guitar, and it was a great event. But I couldn't help but think to myself the entire time he was up on stage that he looked so familiar to me, and I couldn't put my finger on it. So I actually asked his stepfather, like if he had been almost famous. And it turns out that Brendan was on a television show. I believe it was on MTV.
Yeah, MTV.
How's Your News? Yeah, the show was called How's Your News, and it was for people with disability. They went around touring and interviewing celebrities and other people. And I had seen only one episode of the show, but it stuck with me, and Brendan was actually on that show. So ever since then, I went up to him, and we've been friends ever since.
Yeah.
So now I'm sad because this isn't the coolest, best media experience Brendan's ever had. So, well, it's okay because when you're number two, Brendan, there's still room to grow.
Right? Absolutely.
So Brendan, thanks for coming on the show. It's awesome that you're here as a fellow musician and someone who has great appreciation for folks like you. Can you remember back to anything before Best Buddies, or does anybody ever tell you what it was like for you before you came into the Best Buddies program? Or
well, I know for me that when I wasn't in Best Buddies, it was really, really hard for me. I went to high school, and I started Best Buddies in eighth grade, and they didn't have a chapter, so I was able to go to the high school and get involved with the chapter over there. And eventually, our program manager, our chapter president, graduated and moved on. So when that happened, our chapter crumbled pretty much, and we stopped. And then I started getting teased again and bullied a lot. So I lost 25 pounds because of stress. I was in the hospital for 5 days. It was really tough. But Best Buddies has been such an amazing organization, and I couldn't be happier to be involved in it.
So tell us about your first buddy.
Wow. Okay, let's see. My first real buddy that I can remember, her name was actually Alethea, and she was from Tanzania. And at that point in time, I had moved to Massachusetts to go to a post-secondary school for kids with special needs, and they had a chapter there. And so I, became her buddy, and I lived in Massachusetts for a year and a half, and then I moved back to Connecticut, and then I was an associate member with the Yale chapter for 4 years. And then it took Best Buddies to take some time to try and find me citizen's buddy. Mm-hmm. So that took about a year and a half because the first citizen's buddy that they had found for me, it just didn't fit.
Right.
And the citizen's buddy that they found for me was a perfect fit. And yeah, he's awesome.
So who's your awesome buddy now? Besides me.
His name is Caleb. He is actually my former citizen's buddy because he was working in Connecticut, and the company that he worked for, which was Hess, they sold the division of his company, so I had to move out of state. So he moved to Massachusetts.
Yep.
And so so that happened, and so we couldn't be citizen's buddies anymore, but... the greatest thing is that we've stayed in contact. We are the best of friends. He's currently in the Navy, so I haven't seen him in a long time, and I get to see him in a couple weeks, so I'm really, really excited.
Mm. And you told me part of some of the other exciting things is that as a result of your kind of involvement in the program, not only as a player but as a coach, so to speak, you've got connections all over the world with the other folks that are engaged in the program.
I have friends in Egypt, friends in Canada, friends all over the place that are really, really cool and awesome people.
So the bottom line is, could you imagine what your life would be like if it wasn't for Best Buddies?
I could. Oh. And it'd be horrible. Yeah. You know, it'd be, I don't know, Best being involved in such a great organization as Best Buddies has kind of shaped me into the person that I am today. And, you know, I wouldn't want it any other way.
Excellent. So then let's go back to Zach for the last couple of minutes that we have and let folks know how they can get involved.
Yeah, so the Best Buddy Citizens Program, we have an application that everybody that wants to participate has to fill out. You could get it from the link. It's called bestbuddiesonline.org/citizens. So that is the easiest link. There's a button that says member application. You just have to click that. I think you have to click Connecticut over its state office first, and then you fill out the application, and it's a pretty easy process. It just asks you some questions. So once that is all filled out, I will actually contact you. I email everybody that fills out an application, and the next step is a background check. We require a background check for every participant within the organization just to ensure the safety. Unfortunately, it's a crazy world we live in, so never be too safe.
Right.
So the background check costs $15, and that's the only thing that you are required to pay for to participate in Best Buddies. I will send you the information to complete the background check. I'll even help you if you have any issues in filling it out.
Great. If you want to learn more about Best Buddies and the great work they're doing right here in Connecticut, you can go to bestbuddiesct.org, and then from there you can get turned on to or linked into being involved with the Citizens Program, or if you're a parent of a younger child, about how you might be able to get into or start a chapter in your own school community. All great information, and great to learn and have these folks in studio this morning from Best Buddies. Zach Zaccoli is Program Manager for the Adult Friendship Initiative at Best Buddies in Connecticut, and our special guest, Brendan Lemieux from Madison, is a former Best Buddies and now is working with the Adult Friendship Program. Guys, thanks for being in the studio. Happy holidays.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, around the end of the year, a lot of folks get out their checkbooks and do something besides buy things for themselves. They write a check, or they walk by a donation box and put some money in, or they remember their favorite nonprofit or charity, whether it's in their community or an organization that may have helped them or a family member of theirs or a friend, and make a donation of support to help that organization continue its good work. But things are a lot more interesting when you broaden the view and take a look at the fact that individuals and foundations just here in Connecticut alone gave $4.66 billion in charitable contributions and charitable contributions during 2013, according to Giving in Connecticut 2015, a report published by the Connecticut Council for Philanthropy. Giving in Connecticut looks at charitable giving in the state and by Connecticut grantmakers and residents. And we're going to talk about some of the dynamics of that and some of the key findings in the report with the Connecticut Council for Philanthropy's President Maggie Gunther Osborne. She joins us on the line. Maggie, thanks for joining us. Happy holidays to you.
Happy holidays to you, John. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So broadening that sentiment from a philanthropic standpoint here in Connecticut, is it a happy holiday season for our nonprofits?
I think it's been a tough year for the not-for-profit sector as a whole. I think they, like individuals in Connecticut, have really struggled to recover from a recession. For the most part, I think one of the biggest challenges continues to be the state budget and but cuts to key services in the state of Connecticut, and at the same time facing federal cuts and recession, and in many ways, charitable giving, depending on who you are within that sector, being up or down. We did see, and we all know, that the spirit of generosity, even in really difficult times, from individuals continues to remain strong, because I think the most generous people are the people that have experienced need and or been the recipients of generosity. So we continue to see, you know, over 70% of the giving is from individuals, and that in many areas continues to be strong. Mm. Those areas of basic necessities and things, but in other areas really continues to struggle.
Yeah.
I think the field as a whole continues to struggle to build capacity to deal with increased demand as resources are shrinking from every direction.
Mm.
It's been a tough year, but I think the community has also learned a lot about the importance of really collaborating and braiding and weaving things together to try and do the best that they can to meet the needs of people in Connecticut.
Yeah, well, you're in a good position to also kind of unpack something that we kind of see the wrapping of in the news headlines when these budgetary gyrations are going on here in Connecticut, and proposals to make cuts to grants to organizations that provide public and human service initiatives are brought into the mix. It's questionable as to whether or not those are political pawns or political tools or tactics irrelevant of that. I'd like to hear from your point of view what it does to these agencies and organizations when they're put on notice that funding may be compromised from larger revenue streams like the state and the federal government. Does it cause a situation where just out of pure need to survive, some of the resources suddenly and or drastically have to shift toward suddenly maybe not doing as much service to those in need at the end of the line, but turning inward to focus on how they can sustain the revenue and go out and get it from other sources?
Well, I think it's a mixed bag. I think what tends to happen is that the character and the nature of social purpose organizations is to try and drive as much of the resources down to people in need. And so when funding is cut, I think one of the bigger challenges for the state and for organizations long term is that the internal infrastructure things get cut, staffing gets cut,
right.
Capacity to build an organization gets cut, and so you kind of push the problem long term. And more responsibilities put on organizations that have less and less infrastructure to support growing needs.
Right,
and
but
so,
doesn't the threat of the cut or the idea that it may be suddenly and fundamentally cause an internal difference in the way a lot of these very many thinly staffed agencies have to focus their limited energies?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's like anybody. And you have to remember that in general, the data will show you that especially smaller organizations, very, very few of them have any any reserve at all. Mm. So they are living to continue on the edge, and so when there is even a threat of cuts, it puts them in sort of a crazy mode, and they have to do preemptive kinds of activities like let staff go or drop services or whatever that may be. Because of the insecurity, they don't really know. Mm. And so it creates sort of really an unhealthy chaos in communities and in the field of the people that are most vulnerable. Mm. And it also provides a lack of ability for them to advocate and really mount sort of a defense, if you will, of their needs when it comes to state budget conversations and other conversations. You know, they're the least equipped with infrastructure to fight. They're the least equipped with paid lobbyists to really kind of build the case for support for vulnerable populations and communities when this comes to push comes to shove. So it's just a really painful thing to watch.
And critics of these cuts and the threat of these cuts so often are talking about how they're counterproductive because it's sort of like an hourglass effect. If you're taking out from the top, you're just filtering into the bottom, and somewhere along the line, whether people write a check or allocations are made through tax dollars, through state agencies, the burden is still going to come back around on the taxpayer. And I guess a lot of times, because it's the state delivering the services now in some sort of emergency or Band-Aid approach, it's much more costly.
Absolutely much more costly. It pushes it all. You know, it's part of the reason that the Connecticut Council of Philanthropy exists, for us to be able to work with foundations and the infrastructure of the charitable sector to say we need to be getting further up the pipeline with this stuff, because what we continue to do and all of our resources and individual charitable giving is doing remedial work that is the failure of system reform and system change and planning. So, you know, we end up paying for the results of either underfunded or bad policy in our communities when it trickles down to families and individuals. That then we need to do something to assist them, but it's a very short term kind of way of thinking.
Yeah.
It doesn't really build family security and economic well-being for the state of Connecticut.
Sure. Maggie Gunther Osborne's with us. She's president of the Connecticut Council for Philanthropy. We're going to drill into some of the high points of giving in Connecticut 2015, their annual report published by the council. Before we do that, Maggie, for the folks that are listening that are not familiar with your organization, you talked about how a lot of nonprofits are now, the treetops are going away, and there's a lot more cooperation and collaboration. How is this working, and how is the council working to help coach and train this sort of new generation of collaborative nonprofit efforts? In some cases, I would imagine, to be even more effective than they ever could have been as the sum of their parts were scattered to the various individual storefronts and offices across the state.
Well, John, I have my work and the work that the council is specifically on the philanthropic side, so working with foundations, corporate giving programs, community foundations, those who are the grant makers. Our counterpart organization in Connecticut is the Connecticut Council for Not-for-Profits, who is really dealing with the actual not-for-profit agencies. So, but my role in that connection is in working with grant makers to figure out how they can support the collaboration of those not-for-profit partners, and more importantly for me, how philanthropy can learn to cooperate and to braid and weave the things that they're doing together, because there are no single issue areas. Mm. You can't just be someone who wants to fund education to make change in the outcomes for graduation rates and not think about housing. You can't do that without thinking about safety in neighborhoods. And so figuring out how to get leadership and resources aligned to deal with holistic community issues is really the way that we can approach some real change. And it also is a way that good people doing good work in communities can band together to say, what are the core things that I do really, really well, and what are the things that somebody else can do, and how can we band together? And some of this is because it's a good strategy, and some of it is because there is no other choice. There are not enough resources to really fund broad infrastructure for individual groups. So the economy in some ways is forcing collaboration, but when people embrace it and really work at it, and it takes work, because at the end of the day, all collaboration is based on trusted relationships,
mm-hmm.
and that takes time. And when you're in a period of chaos, it's really challenging to build trust when you're fighting for your life, so to speak, and for your clients and for your community. So I think it is the way forward. I think we're seeing more of it. I think as people are understanding it is the only way forward, that is growing, and that my role and the Connecticut Council for Philanthropy's role is to get funders to do the same things we're asking our grantees to do and asking agencies to do, and for us to not go it alone and to really think about how we much more strategically weave our work together to better impact.
Okay. Well, turning our attention in the last few minutes that we have to Giving in Connecticut, your annual report, there is an interesting talking point here in terms of the fact that foundations in Connecticut gave about a 1% decrease in support between 2012 and 2013. However, those foundation assets increased almost 23% in that same time. Can you give us a little analysis about what that means?
Well, I think a majority of that is because, as you can tell by, if you look at the data in the report, which is available on our website and for anyone to peruse, the majority of those dollars are in private and individual kinds of foundations. So it was a very good year in the stock market. I think that there is a huge rise in donor advised funds and the creation of continued creation of private foundations, but also the real funding of it after many years of sort of slow progress. I think people are in a wait and see mode. There are a lot of things that were very uncertain politically, both at the national and the local level. And so I think that there has been a year of kind of wait and see, so assets have really grown. And my encouragement to philanthropy in general in Connecticut and across the country with my colleagues is, all right, so now we really need to think about how to deploy those assets in a strategic way as the state continues to struggle to really make a difference and to work across municipalities and across boundaries so that we're really serving in an equitable way the people in the state of Connecticut. And so I hope that we'll see in the year following this 2013 data that in 2014 and 2015, as that recovery really happened, that we'll see significant assets deployed, but we don't have that data yet.
Yeah. You also made an example a little bit earlier about folks who are writing checks and foundations and other agencies that are stepping up their attention to education. And in fact, in this latest report, the donations to education initiatives outpaced donations to human service agencies by almost 4%.
And I think they always will, because that bucket is so large. So that bucket includes anybody who's making contributions to support early childhood education, to people who are putting names on buildings at major universities. So it's sort of this, and everything in K-12 and scholarship. I mean, it's an enormous bucket, and that's one of the challenges that the council is also working with our national partners at the Foundation Center to be able to get better, more accurate, more precise data to really analyze exactly where those dollars are going, so that we can parse out what's really much more on the ground and community investment as opposed to perhaps a capital campaign, or even what is further national or international. About 60% of the grant dollars that are referred to in this giving are going outside the state of Connecticut. So the people who are doing global philanthropy or people whose philanthropy and grants are going back to national initiatives or where money originally came from, or a great deal of the foundation money that is housed within Fairfax County, my assumption is a lot of it is moving towards New York and other places. So the data is so at the treetops, as you think about it, and we really need to get down to the roots of really analyzing that. So that's a big project that we're working on now to try and really improve access to quality and precise data about philanthropy and where the money is really going and who it's really impacting so that we can, again, weave it together and do a much better job for the people and the places in Connecticut that we really care about.
And the bottom line in the last minute that we have with you, Maggie, is it all just really comes back down all the way back to the beginning of our program. As we mentioned, it's all about the individual who drops a few dollars or writes a check, whether it's impulsively over something they've heard or seen or experienced themselves, or an organization that they just have regularly supported for many years.
Well, and I will say that in the spirit of this time of the year of great generosity, if you can't be motivated by looking around you and look, be motivated by the fact that science has now proven that giving and being a charitable and empathetic human being will make you live longer and much happier. So in the spirit of that, I wish everybody a long and happy life, and that they really
exercise their checkbooks as much as they do at the gym.
Exercise their checkbooks and therefore their health and joy through this really important giving season and throughout the year.
All right. So everybody heard it. Two resolutions, both involving exercise in the new year. Exercise yourself and exercise your checkbook. You'll live longer, and you'll do so much good here in Connecticut. Maggie Gunther Olson is president of the Connecticut Council for Philanthropy. Their latest report, Giving in Connecticut 2015, is available for you now at ctphilanthropy.org. Happy New Year, Maggie. Thanks for being on the program. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audiences and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Vayette. I'm John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for another installment of the award-winning For the People. Or listen to this and other For the People podcasts under the podcast tab at our radio station website or on iTunes. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.